G'day, this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be with Robert Fee and Paul Fishwick. Maybe, Robert, you can tell us who you are and your background.
Well, surely. I'm somewhat of a newcomer to ATEC. I recently retired from a career of teaching design and design management at Savannah College of Art and Design. Prior to that, I was an industrial designer and department manager at Texas Instruments for about 15 years. So I come from a pretty classical design background, but my mission at SCAD was to bring that interdisciplinary joy of discovery into the students' minds.
Excellent. Paul?
Okay. I started out life, I guess, working for a shipbuilding company and a programmer analyst, and worked as a systems analyst at NASA Langley, and then I was at University of Florida. I'm here now, and I am bridging two schools, arts, technology, emerging communication, and engineering, computer science specifically. So glad to be here.
So I'm Roger Molina. I'm originally an astrophysicist, but now a professor in art and technology and the Department of Physics here. And so indeed, the discussion that we'd like to have today is coming out of a series of discussions on what's called the STEM to STEAM movement, which is integrating art and design into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And one of the topics that surfaced a couple of weeks ago is this word design that has now gone viral and everybody uses it because it's a good idea. And yet every community of research or practice or engineering uses it in a different way. So maybe we could just talk about design to begin with. So Robert, would you like to weigh in?
Why certainly, yeah. And since I come from a field that has design in its name, industrial design, that makes me an expert, perhaps, but not really. But we try to break design down into this dictionary terms. So what does it mean to imagine, to plan, or to prepare? And design is also a noun, so we can say this object has a good design to it. So that is a common thread in all of the creative arts and sciences, including engineering, science, and the behavioral sciences. So that's a good place to start.
So it's Paul, you want to just add to that?
Yeah, most of my career is about soft design of software, large scale software systems. And so in that design, I suppose mostly we think about functionality. But it also gets into the aesthetics of the look and feel, especially when we use models. And models tend to be diagrammatic. And when you're trying to create a diagram, you have to think about the user and what their background is, because a diagram may be look a little bit different depending on who the user is. And so some aspects of UX design or user experience, I think, play in at that point.
And I guess, you know, what I'd add to this discussion is I think there's a sense that in the world today, there's a very high value to understanding the human uses of what's being designed. And that in general, I have to be careful, that often in engineering, one sub-optimizes and looks at the human-computer interface as a sort of a very narrow question. When in fact, in many situations, you're really looking at human uses in a much larger context. And so that a lot of engineering has sub-optimized the whole question of design. And of course, some companies have been remarkably successful because they understood the question was not just the human-computer interface, but the usages, the social context, the social added value. So, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take that one on. Sometimes we would use the terms interface and interaction as a slightly contrasting term. So, the interface could be like the electrical outlet in your wall. It's very direct. You plug something in and whatever it is on the other end lights up. Pretty simple. In interaction, is now implied by, say, an Ethernet outlet on the wall, even though it's still physically easy to plug in, but it implies so much more. In other words, interaction design is what I used to think of as how you interact or how you behave relative to an object or environment through an intermediary machine. So you do that with a hammer and a nail, but it's very simple. We understand it. When you do it with a computer, and that includes the ones in your pocket, it's by being smart, that means it's as smart as a four-year-old child. It's going to behave the way it wants to behave as often as the way you want it to behave.
Paul, you want to add?
So my first thought is it takes the way back machine in a direction where the idea of the human interacting with a computer was watching basically somebody who took the card stack and put it in what's so-called card hopper. This is how you do did programming with punch cards. At that point in time, my human interaction was basically passing something to an individual with a white lab coat behind a glass wall. Now look at where we are now. We take something like our phones, our smartphones. Along with the miniaturization, I think has also provided this new possibility for a whole lot of different ways of the experiencing tactile sensation, of course the audio sense, the visual sense. It's all there and it's become much cheaper and more prevalent. So that's got to make design more relevant to computing than it used to be as far as human design.
Well, Paul, your example made me think that how often we complain about how hard our phone or our computer is to use, but when you describe it, and I remember when the men in the lab coats took the punch cards, it's remarkable these things are operable as well as they are by ordinary people who aren't computer science engineers.
Right. It's, and I think that's where hopefully, and the designers I think have always played a key role here. They're going always back to make sure that whatever they're creating has the right effect, because you assume that we know what people are going to do, but we're not sure unless you have a focus group mm-hmm. or some other way of actually testing it against real people in real situations.
Okay, so I'm just going to jump in. And so indeed, you know, this discussion is taking place all over the planet right now. One of the reasons that we think and people think that it's a good time to get artists and designers and engineers talking together more is indeed the kind of issues that you've raised. Immediately then the question is, how do you teach these things? Because clearly teaching design at the Savannah College of Art and Design, you're dealing with a certain kind of student. Here at UT Dallas in engineering computer science, it's maybe a different kind of student. One of the things you talked about, Paul, and you sort of seeded us with, is this idea that if you're teaching design, there are different ways to approach it. You talked about problem-based design, project-based, object-based, and topic-based. You want to just expand on that a little bit?
Sure. The first two, problem-based learning, or just problem-based, and project-based, are terms that are used often within the broader education community. Typically what they do there is they'll start with a problem. Rather than teaching a specific disciplinary topic, you start with a problem. It could be a societal problem. And then from there, you create a project. And of course, you could start the other way. You could start with a project that's common to the individuals to work together, or you could use you could start with a problem. The other approach, object-based learning, is something that's been touted by museums such as the Smithsonian. And there, museums are full of, they're not full of disciplines like we are in universities. They're full of objects, which are very different. They're completely different, right? So an object can speak many different languages to many disciplines, whereas in universities we've tended to kind of silo off and brick ourselves up into particular ones. Like, are you doing engineering design? You go into this building. If you're doing visual design or user experience design, you go to another building.
you want to weigh in on the sort of this map of entry points into education?
Well, yeah. One thing I learned a long time ago, and this was at Texas Instruments, is that in any, we'll call it creative endeavor, there are multiple points of entry. And there are certain disciplines. In fact, I think engineering has suffered from this. Let's just pick on mechanical engineering. And even to this day, so many of the engineering problems engineers work on are very well defined. Let's take this device, make it smaller, lighter, more economical to use, and able to use less energy. Those are well defined goals. But once we get, as Paul mentioned, we get miniaturization down. So you could have your phone the size of a hair clip, they become too small to use. So now the problems become a little different. It's not just how do we make it small and yet keep it easy enough to use. It's how do we make something that people will want and need and be able to understand how to use it and create that level of delight. And then how do we engineer that? And if it's just handed off to an engineer, all we've done is reverse that trip from the technical design to the aesthetic skin. We're just now reversing that from the skin to the bones. So what I hear here at ATEC is this maniacal desire to infuse all of this so that the physicists and the behavioral scientists and the sculptor share in this joy of discovery and putting ideas into action.
And I guess one of the ironies is that the way that university curricula have been designed in the last 50 years, we ask our students to specialize very highly at the entry level, and then as they go through, they have to get interdisciplinary. Right, and so clearly by the time you're in working for TI, you're in a problem-based or a project-based environment, and clearly the way we've designed the education is sort of upside down from mm-hmm. that point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the challenges then is how, if you want to teach art and technology or this interaction, how do you teach it?
So objects, Roger, maybe that's one way of sort of handling it. Again, the object-based learning that is at the heart of museum teaching, if you can have an object and then you could tie an art meaning to it and an engineering meaning, for example, the object is happy to do that as long as we have the technology to show those two different viewpoints. So that's one way, that's one practical way of being able to see something from two different angles, and probably a little bit easier than having co-teaching and other approaches.
Robert, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think that context is starting to play a more important role in all of the objects. Paul had given a presentation about an hour ago in which several of the faculty was looking at an abstract piece of sculpture and then describing it in their own terms. It's really interesting because I don't think anybody in the room could help but start to formulate their own image of what they would do if they were participating. It's really fascinating because I kept thinking of this object not as an object of art but as part of an environment. And it just underscores how important it is to understand multiple points of view with any object. It's just more difficult now than ever before to pin down tangible requirements for a designed object or a program.
Okay, so we don't have very much more time to talk about this, but I'm just going to kind of lay the seed for what might be a future podcast. So one of the projects that you're working on is with the Dallas Museum of Art and some of the other museums in our city, the Nasher and so on, and discussing how we might work with them to allow their objects to be interpreted in different ways. And maybe you can just explain that very briefly, and then one of the sort of discussion points then becomes the context question. So, what kind of context do we want a museum to be? And do we want the objects to speak to us or not? So, Paul,
those are great questions. And we don't know the answers to the questions yet, but yeah, we are working with a few museums, and the idea is, can we leverage technology that gives us the location of the visitor, namely next to the sculpture, for example, and then perhaps using the visitor's profile in some way, that is their interests, their natural interests that they have coming into that space, can they actually steer the knowledge that they get from the sculpture in different ways? We're doing that right now in newspapers online and magazines that you can create out of your own profile. As to whether we can do it with museums, that's sort of up in the air right now.
Robert, you want to jump in on
I'm fascinated with the role a museum plays. I love to go to them because oftentimes what you see is just a plain old object, but yet the museum environment creates such a focal element there that you can't help but see it differently. Yet I think that museums in the future, one of my futures class about 3 years ago did a project on the future of museums, and the one set of scenarios looked at what would happen if government funding dried up, and the interesting thing is, even today, most museums are funded by foundations. And so if you looked at then the challenges facing public schools, who already take numerous field trips to museums, but what if you expanded that interrelationship to where the museum became this fountain of learning, and it's not just outreach, it's really more of a collaboration with the educational system. That would be interesting to me.
But we'll just end this with the nightmare scenario. And so, indeed, if the museum is busy collecting data on all its visitors, it anticipates what the visitor should be interested in, and then the visitor is told what to look at. And that's kind of a nightmare scenario where, indeed, we all feel uneasy now the way a lot of these systems online anticipate desires and then steer us towards the desires that are going to give those people a profit. Versus a very open idea of the context of the museum as a place of contemplation, where indeed it's maybe a random walk, a Brownian motion through an environment, driven by your mood at the time, and maybe you're not normally interested in this, but you're, and so we get into very different sort of context designs of what it is we want a museum to offer. I don't know, Paul, you want to just about the nightmare scenario of
the
museum that anticipates what objects you should look at?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there'd be, you know, there's two words, sort of personalization and customization, and they're really two ends of the same continuum. You know, let's say personalization is where it's the service which is predicting what you want all the time, and you don't have any input. Customization is exactly the opposite, where you customize everything yourself. Kind of think of like a pizza. You specify every ingredient, what dough you want. Do you want whole wheat or do you want white? Do you want thin or thick crust? So, you know, the pizza, that would be the customization, versus the personalization for a pizza would be you go to the pizza place and they go, oh, we've got what you want already. We know what you want because you bought here 10 times before. So there's got to be a balance, and I think for every individual is going to be a different sort of balance.
Okay, Robert, we'll give you the final word.
Well, I think building on that metaphor is a really good one. Food really works here because if you look at curation, which is a major part of museums, and then you take that into the restaurant sphere, if I want to go out and taste what a great chef puts together, I'm not going to be able, nor do I want to, design my own salad dressing. So between that, ordering your pizza and experiencing a fine chef's work, I think that's where museums lie, and they're on one end and they're probably moving closer toward the center. They're going to include more.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll end the discussion. Thank you very much, Robert and Paul.
Thank you.
Okay.